2019 is Heritage Radio Network's 10th birthday, and we've got a lot to celebrate. We need your support to bring you another year of the best in food radio. Help HRN ring in its second decade by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hello and welcome to another awesome episode. Our last one of the Why Food podcast, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, career changers, food people changing the world, I guess. We need a better tagline. It's been long enough. Come on.
Last episode of 2018, to clarify, we're not just leaving.
No, we're no, even if you don't like our voices, we're still going to be making noises on microphones for the foreseeable future. But it is our last episode of the season, and we are super excited to welcome Chitra Agarwal, who is the co-founder and CEO of Brooklyn Deli. Chitra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having.
Tell us about Brooklyn Deli. Who are you and what do you do?
So Brooklyn Deli, we make sauces and condiments that are inspired by Indian culinary traditions. And I founded the company with my husband, Ben, who designs all the packaging and I do all the recipe development.
And can you tell us about your signature products? We have some here today.
Yes. So the first product that we came out with is actually my tomato achar, which is a spicy Indian condiment, and followed by my roasted garlic achar, rhubarb ginger, and now we have curry ketchup and a curry mustard.
What is achar for anybody who doesn't know?
Yes, so achar means pickled or preserved in Hindi, and it's a condiment, a staple condiment that is found in most Indian homes, a lot of times made from green mangoes or limes, and it has a very pungent flavor. It's sour, spicy, savory, and you use just a little bit mixed into rice or curry or rice and lentils usually.
Is it a finishing? Is it a condiment, or is it something that is used in the cooking process as well?
Usually it's used after, so you just add a little bit on. But people sometimes will put it into like dal just to flavor it. And my mom, my family would put it in sandwiches too. So.
You've said that Brooklyn Deli is really a reflection of the fact that you grew up eating American foods, but also a lot of traditional Indian foods. Can you kind of tell us about how the products reflect that, the flavors of the products reflect that?
Yeah, so I'd say so if you were to eat an achar that you bought in an Indian store, you'd probably find it extremely salty. And so that's one thing that I realized is that a lot of the achars that my family would make were less salty. You could taste the flavor of the produce that was being preserved more. And the achars that I make, I wanted to reflect that homemade quality in them. So I'd say that that's kind of what would be different. And of course, I use rhubarb in one of mine, which is not traditional. And I also, we roast the garlic in my garlic achar, which is also not usual. You will find a tomato achar, though, in South India. But of course, it's made in so many different ways. So this is like my recipe.
And what about the curry ketchups? Like you said that they're also kind of comes from the achar, but a little different.
Yeah. So the curry ketchup is actually something that we would make at home where we would take ketchup and mix it with the tomato achar because it has the same flavor profile as the tomato achar, but it has more of a sweetness and a tanginess that goes quite well with grilled cheese. We eat so much grilled cheese at home. It's like, but yeah, and then the curry mustard is a mustard that is tangy with tamarind, and then I make a curry, like a spice blend that flavors it. And, you know, we use like three different types of mustards that are brined overnight and then ground fresh with all of these different ingredients.
you've built a really remarkable business, and remarkable in a lot of ways, both because it's been bootstrapped, which is significant, but also because you took a set of flavors that most Americans were not super familiar with. Maybe they'd read about them, or they'd heard about them, or they knew the word achar, but maybe couldn't place it or couldn't describe an achar to you. And now your curry, ketchup, and mustard are in Whole Foods nationally, and you've gotten significant distribution with these products. So do you, I guess it's a huge question, but how did you do that? How did you take this sort of esoteric product and flavor profile and make it so ubiquitous?
So you're saying how I took...
how did you build such a cool business is what I'm asking.
Being very naive. Okay. So, I mean, I think that a lot of people that kind of come from the background that I have, I did a lot of kind of pop-up dinners and cooking classes, a very kind of community-based food perspective. So I created these things, these recipes, a lot of times based off of what I would get in my CSA. And I'd serve them and got good response. And we thought, you know, let's put these out, you know. And I think we just kind of learned as we went along, but it has not been an easy road, though.
Yeah, it never is.
Yeah, and achar, I mean, a lot of people, achar is the Hindi way to say Indian pickle, too. So in that sense, we came out with a very specific name, which coming from a culinary, like, I wanted to teach people. So I was like, people can learn how to say Indian pickle, but in Hindi. But for instance, my mom is from South India, and it's called Upinkai there. So we were like, Upinkai or achar?
why did you pick achar ultimately?
Because, well, it's easier to fit onto the label. And I mean, even with achar, it's like a lot of people are like, oh, I love your achar.
Yeah.
Or I love, you would be surprised as to like how it gets mispronounced.
Can you talk more about that education process? And I mean, it is really hard to not even just strum up demand for a product that people already know. We've had other entrepreneurs who have food products, and you know, they have their own struggles, but then to introduce them something that they didn't know they needed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so that was the other thing, is that we were the first achar, really, that was in kind of like the Western markets, and that attracted a lot of attention. So right off the bat, we were featured in all of these magazines like Saveur, Food and Wine, New York Times. We don't have any PR, and like we got all of this press and this interest because we had put something out that was different, mm-hmm. that people were very drawn to as far as the flavors. And so that part was cool because it was exciting. But from the consumer standpoint, from, you know, a larger perspective, it's that people don't know what it is, though, or didn't know what it was. So you would have to kind of like read those articles, seek it out to kind of know what it is.
And so when buyers were stocking the shelves with the achar, like how were you able to translate that to consumers, and, you know, kind of what is the ongoing process of continuing to educate more and more consumers?
Well, I mean, with the stores, we would do a lot of demoing. So demoing was key. And in the beginning, I also did a lot of markets. So that was probably the main way that we got our first customers. And of course, also people that had followed my blog or come to my pop-up dinners and events. I mean, we sometimes send surveys out to people asking, how did you find out about our brand? And a lot of people are like, I've been following your blog since, like, you know. So there's a lot of kind of like crossover from that audience. Yeah. So
tell us about that transition, because you were working in, you'd had all kinds of jobs before doing this, and the blog seems like it served as sort of a transitional process for you from other employment to launching Brooklyn Deli. Tell us about that
Yeah, so I started the blog. I had a day job at an internet radio station, and I started to become really interested in exploring my family's recipes from India. And I've always been interested in visiting India and going there. My parents lived there for half the year. So they, whenever they would go, I would make it a point to also go because I was very close to my grandmother and her sisters. And that's really how I started to kind of document and note these recipes down, because I also felt like they were fleeting, that my grandmother has passed away since, but I still have, you know, records, all these notes and everything like that. And my parents also love to cook. So the blog was a way for me to document. And in the beginning, it was like, I mean, my mom would read it. And like, I think that like relatives would read it, because I was kind of putting down these recipes that we would be trading in emails and things like that. And then it just started to, people started to find it, I think.
You also had a cookbook that came out of your blog.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what that's like? And also, I mean, I think that's actually, the more and more people who blog are starting to do cookbooks, but they are quite different, just what that process is like.
Yeah, so with the cookbook, so I was blogging, and I had started doing Instagram, and kind of in the very beginning, and that was when I got the interest of a publisher, and at the time, I didn't know what it is I wanted to write about, and because I was also exploring. My father's from North India, my mom is from South India, so the cuisine is very different. And I was doing a lot of these events where I would kind of mash up, you know, local produce or different influences with these recipes. And I remember being approached and being like, starting to write this proposal and not really knowing where I wanted it to go. So I kind of tabled it and decided that I would just have fun with whatever I was doing and see where it leads. And maybe at some point I would have, you know, an idea of what I wanted to write about. And that happened for me because I became very interested in my mom's recipes from South India, which are not known as well known as Northern Indian recipes. And I started teaching those recipes and making my own versions of those recipes with what I would get in the CSA. And I found that people were drawn to these recipes. They're like, they're really light and fresh, and they make good use of seasonal produce, and you know, they're a lot of vegan, a lot of them are vegan. And so that was when I started to pick back the proposal up and decide to go in that route, because I knew I had enough material and interest in myself to devote a whole book to that topic.
Were you working on Brooklyn Deli at that time, or is that came later?
So I got the book deal, I'd say almost right before we launched Brooklyn Deli, which I do not recommend to people because it was like craziness. Writing a cookbook and starting a business, a packaged food business, is with minimal help is definitely not, you know, what you want to do.
And how did those two projects work together for you? How did you see them influencing each other?
I'd say that I think what the recipe development that I did for the cookbook actually is going to inform some of the recipes or the products that we come out with for Brooklyn Deli. And I learned a lot just recipe testing for that book. And having this mindset coming from Brooklyn Deli of we make shelf-stable products, to understand like, oh, actually, you know, this product is naturally shelf-stable. This one could work. Like, so I think that the recipe development is kind of fluid between the two projects.
How did you pick which product to launch first? I'm sure you had many options, but how do you pick which flavor? And also, I'm looking at the design now. Like, it's a very like specific and kind of like cohesive design. Like, what were you going for when you were looking at how you would be placed on the shelves?
So, yeah, like with the tomato achar, I mean, this product was something that I remember the first ones that I made were from heirloom tomatoes, which we can't afford to do.
But very like, expensive.
Yeah. But we realized that, like, my husband, he didn't know what Indian pickle or achar was before he met me. And I would bring back all of these different different varieties from my family and from markets in India. And, you know, we would eat those and finish them. And then we'd be like, we can't get like a good green mango pickle, you know, that like here in the store, you would buy it and it like has all this like gunk in it. It's like really salty. So when I made this tomato achar, that was one of the first ones that I made. We started to use it just like we were using the Indian pickle, except the Indian pickle, we were just putting on rice and dal or rice and curry, but the tomato achar, we were putting on like eggs, we were putting on sandwiches, we started using it on everything. And that's when we started to think, this product could be like a crossover product, you know?
Had you wanted to start a business? Was that an aspiration for a long time? Or what was the moment where you finally decided to go for it?
I never thought that like, this is not, I am a very risk averse person, and I have results from a recent like assessment that even proves that. But like it really, I kind of just went with it. Ben was like, you know, he's like, I love this product, I see how people respond to it, I can design the packaging. Uh-huh. Let's do this together. And for me, I was like, it sounded exciting. Like, and we just kind of jumped right in, basically.
What were some of the moments that where you regretted that decision?
Well, I'd say, I mean, when we first started the business, it's like, we were off to a great start. We got all this press, all these buyers were calling us and everything. And I think the first time that I was like, oh God, what are we doing? Is when we realized that the product wasn't selling. Like, the buyers were excited about it. Mm-hmm. We had all this press behind us, but it's just like people didn't know what achar was. And so, I mean, that's when we started to demo and then see people's reactions to it. And I think that's what kept us going, is people's reactions to the flavor of it.
You've also said that you're starting to move more into restaurants and food service, and the achar is in Blue Apron kits. Can you talk a little bit about that pivot and how you decided to start focusing there?
Yeah, so we realized that when we demoed the product, it would sell off the shelf, but we didn't have the funding to invest into like a large scale demoing strategy. So we were like, you know, and the other part of it also is that in a grocery store, we found, and I'm guilty of this too, it's like you go into a grocery store and you're kind of, you buy what you usually buy.
Yeah.
And maybe you
what
buy
you
some.
Need.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're not really, I mean, I know I'm not. I'm like, I buy the same stuff. And I'm not really in this mode of like exploration or anything. And I think that the tomato achar and the people that love this product when I was first making it came to like my pop-up dinners or to my blog because they want to learn something new. They want to taste something new. Mm-hmm. And we were like, where can we get back to where people are in that mindset? And that was why we were like, okay, it's restaurants and meal kits. People are paying for these curated experiences, yeah, to discover flavors, like our flavors. And so that was kind of like a moment where we're like, duh, you know? So that's kind of...
And how has the meal kits been going? Like, what has the reaction been? And can you see them translating into customers who are then buying full-size products?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's kind of... It's staggering. I mean, it's basically... I mean, we have people emailing us saying, I had your product in Blue Apron, and I tried to make the recipe without it or doing, you know, using something else, and it wasn't the same. And they're just like, we love it. And Blue Apron has like re-signed, and they continue to put us in a ton of recipes. And the cool part is they're putting us in recipes that are not just Indian too. Mm-hmm. So it's like they're really using the flavor. And like you can see the difference. I mean, our online sales from after Blue Apron have increased by like a large amount, basically like 300 or 400 times from like last year. Because people are searching for it, and we can see they're searching for it and coming to our site.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in 2 minutes, so stay tuned.
Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio, for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.
And we're back. I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey, and today we have Chitra Ugarwal, who is the co-founder and CEO of Brooklyn Deli. We were just talking about how Blue Apron helped your business a lot, getting people onto your site, buying your products, and also just getting more used to your flavors. What I was going to ask as a follow-up to that is, do you feel that we were talking a little over lunch about kind of the ethnic category or the specialty category. How do you expand people's perception of your products beyond just an Indian sauce or just an ethnic sauce, but something that they can kind of use to the everyday and to expanding your brand beyond that as well?
Well, for us, I mean, it was definitely education. And so having been, I mean, blogging, recipe development came easily for me, and we eat it almost every day. So when I would demo, I would give out recipe cards for people how to make something with it. I think our first one, like, I remember we designed a tomato achar shakshuka recipe card, which has been very popular. People are like, that's what I make with your product. I'm like, wow. It's like stuck. But yeah, we would do a lot of education as to like how you'd use it. I mean, even the way we designed the label at the bottom, it's like, try it on. And there's all these different things. And that kind of, Ben designed that because it was reminiscent of the Brooklyn, a Brooklyn deli awning, right? Uh-huh. Where it like has all these like different things,
fish appetizing.
Yeah, basically.
All right, so we're gonna do one of our favorite things to do on the air. Regular Yay. Listeners will know that we love eating things into the microphone. I apologize in advance. So, but we're gonna taste. That's the tomato achar, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Go. I got a nice pop with that.
How would you, Chitra? How would you describe the flavor of?
The flavor is, it's savory, it's tangy, there's a tiny bit of sweetness from jaggery, an Indian sweetener.
And what is that?
That's great. It's,
What is jaggery?
Oh, jaggery, it's basically like pure cane. cane sugar. It's like, it has a more kind of like deeper flavor than, you know, than a molasses or than like a regular sugar.
And it's a, like a dark color, like a,
yeah,
a dark red color.
Oh. Yeah.
It's delicious.
So then excellent. You get the heat at the end. And we have sesame oil in it, Indian sesame oil.
How is Indian sesame oil different?
It's the process of manufacturing it is it's different. So it's I'd say like when I use kind of the like a pure sesame oil in dressings, it's more nutty. This is more mild in its flavor, but a lot of times it's traditionally used in preservation in South Indian cooking for pickles. Like in India, you'll see throughout India, north, south, all different places, they'll use different oils to preserve the produce in achars. So like North India, they'll use mustard oil. South India, a lot of times sesame oil.
Where do those traditions come from? Is that just the oils that were available historically?
Yeah, definitely. I'm like, I need to put this on something.
it tastes, it's like the best tomato sauce you've ever eaten, right?
It's
like
very this, craveable.
Yeah, very savory. Tons of umami, a little bit of spiciness at the end.
Actually, the umami comes from asafoetida. Mm. So we use
Tell us what that is.
So asafoetida is it's basically a resin that's derived from the sap of a fennel plant. And when you fry this spice in oil or butter, it has kind of like a flavor of garlic or leeks. And the reason it's used a lot, especially in Brahmin households where, and some Jain households where, I guess garlic and onions are not used in cooking. Mm. So people use asafoetida, or also sometimes called hing, as a way to impart that flavor. And it does add an umami aspect to Indian cooking. I always feel like a lot of times people will make Indian recipes and they'll leave out the asafoetida because it's a spice that is not available, like as readily
it's hard
available.
To find.
You can find it online now or at certain grocers, but that's the flavor they're missing, I think.
I just bought a bunch from Patel Bros.
Yeah. It has a reputation for having kind of an unpleasant smell. How does that translate into a finished product?
Oh, for the hing?
Yeah.
Oh, well, definitely keep it capped. I mean, it's so strong. I just remember my husband loves hing. So I've taught him how to like make all these recipes using hing and black mustard seeds, like kind of like South Indian spices. And he makes this popcorn that is so good. I put it in the cookbook. It's basically, you know, fried hing, mustard seeds, curry leaves, and red chilies in butter that he flavors the popcorn with nutritional yeast, too.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing about hing, though, is that you can buy it pure in its resin form, which I a lot of times use and I get from a place in Bangalore. And you grind that and you can use it. But then in most stores, you'll buy a powdered form that is cut with wheat flour or rice flour. We use a form that's cut with fenugreek seed powder. And that form is not as potent. So we were at my parents' house, and we always make popcorn. We make this popcorn and we bring it to the theater, right? And Ben at my parents' house, they have the pure hing that is really potent. And Ben was making this popcorn to take, and he just put in like as if he was using kind of like the cut hing. And we took that popcorn to the movie theater, and it reeked. Like, it was good, but it reeked.
I'm so many delicious things smell not savory.
Yeah, it does seem like there's something in the cooking process also with hing that sort of softens that the intensity that makes it a little more, I don't know, less powerful, more sort of background background savoriness that you get in your tomato achar.
It's like that no you can't place.
Yeah.
It yeah. rounds it. Yeah.
What is the tart component of the achar?
Oh, tamarind.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I feel like you asked me what was in it, and they're slowly the ingredients are slowly coming out. And also, there is fenugreek seed powder, and that adds a kind of nutty flavor to it.
So let's talk a little bit more about the cultural aspects of serving. I guess, would you call them Indian flavors to American audiences, and convincing people to try something they haven't tried before. Also, your curry ketchup and curry mustard being newer products, but maybe also kind of gateway products for people.
Gateway drug.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's the perfect way of looking at it. I feel like the curry ketchup and the curry mustard are gateways for people to try to get deeper into Indian flavors. Because, I mean, when we started Brooklyn Deli, that's the main goal, is to educate people on Indian flavors. And that's what we do through the products. And the achars are on the spectrum of more traditional flavors, and the curry ketchup and the curry mustard are kind of like more of these hybrid products that hopefully, you know, people will try those and be like, I want to go deeper. And so they'll, you know, want to explore more and become interested.
How did you come up with the ideas of the rhubarb ginger or the roasted garlic? And since they're kind of these untraditional flavors for achars, like, what is kind of your stance on like that authenticity? How authentic do your flavors need to be if you're presenting it to a large audience?
I mean, those flavors were ones that I developed literally, like, from the farm share.
Mm-hmm.
I would get a bunch of rhubarb, and I was like, what do I want to do? I don't really, at that time, I feel like now I eat sweet things. I feel like after I had a baby, now I like sweets. But before, I did not like sweet things. So I feel like a lot of times people put rhubarb in sweet preparations. Mm-hmm. And I was bent on making a pickle and a char with the rhubarb, and I looked to my grandmother would make this South Indian pickle that was using green mango, and so in place of the green mango I used the rhubarb. So it's rhubarb ginger with the black mustard seeds, asafoetida, it has that same, when people try it that are South Indian, they get it. They get that same kind of feeling, I think. And that's what I was going for. And the recipes are literally recipes that I like had made. And I had noted these recipes. And when we wanted to package them, they were already shelf stable too, naturally, just from like the techniques I was using too.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Could you walk us through that the life cycle of one of those recipes, how you took it from something that you were making at home and turned it into a product in a jar on a shelf that's distributed nationally? That's I'm sure there were 1,000 steps in that process. What were some of those steps, and how did you figure them out?
So having been in this community in Brooklyn for, for a while, I had a lot of friends that had launched products, packaged products. So when I was deciding that, okay, we're going to do this, I literally just reached out to my network. And I remember like my friend Kadeem, who has Mama O's Kimchi, he like came over and he's like, hey, I'll show you where to go for the bottles and like all this stuff. And, you know, so it was kind of like, I just kind of just relied on friends to know what to do, the processes. I relied on Cornell has that food venture center that I definitely leaned on them for getting, you have to get a scheduled process for a shelf stable product. But the recipes pretty much were untouched from what I had developed and was serving to the bottle. Basically. And, but going from like, you know, developing this recipe in my home kitchen, and then, we started making the achars in a soup pantry in Brooklyn, at St. John's, Bread and Life. And that was the first time where I was like, we were boiling so many tomatoes, and I was just like, this is like hot lava. Like, we're just, what, like, how are we gonna get this into a bottle? You know, so dealing with these kind of like scale up like issues as far as like recipe scaling, definitely went through them. And it was great though, because you learn as you go, and that's what I love about this too. It's like I learn something new every day, and so yeah.
Are you planning to co-pack the product in the future, or is it co-packed now?
Yeah, so we actually, we got like our largest order when I had just had my baby, and it was just like kind of overwhelming. We had started to kind of like look into different facilities for like scale up, and in case, like, you know, if this if something came to us that we couldn't produce, because actually we had had that we had that experience where a store had come to us and they wanted a large quantity and we just couldn't do it. And at that point I was like, well, I don't want another opportunity like that to come along and to say no to it. So we had started to research these things. And when the opportunity came, we had a place that we had vetted, and they made the first, you know, that was maybe 4 years into our business that we had a co-packer make them, especially for Blue Apron, because we pack in small cups too, which we like can't do that.
Was that a hard transition to have somebody else manufacturing your product?
It was and it wasn't, because the facility that we use, I was like, I'm on the floor, so I'm tasting the product as it's being made. So maybe I'm not like pouring, you know, like
you're not sitting like, there with a huge spoon stirring the tomatoes.
Yeah, I'm there, and I am seeing that, you know, the product is what it is, because it's like, it's a personal product that, like, you know, and I'm sure that I may be one of those customers too that is like super annoying, but at the end of the day, it's like, I just wanted to taste the way I wanted to taste.
And then how did the curry ketchup and curry mustard come about?
Yeah, so the curry ketchup was something that we would make at home, and you know, Ben and I were kind of preparing for a trade show in California. It was like the fancy food show, and there was a couple of ideas that we were thinking about, and Ben was like, you know what, I'm going to design some of these concept sheets. Let's take some concept sheets to this shop. So we're like, okay. So we had a bunch of these ideas, and he designed, I mean, they looked amazing. And so we go to the show, and a buyer from Whole Foods comes up, and she's like, I love your achars. You know, and she's like, I want to take them national. I think, like, I think that it would be a good product for us. And, you know, Ben and I had just come to this realization where we're like, achar is not grocery material right now. Like, we're going full heads, like, with this restaurant, you know, meal kit strategy. And we can't support the product with demoing. We don't have the funds to do that. But we do have a couple of other ideas that we're kind of thinking about. You know, would you like to look at them? So we pull out our concept sheets.
And the products didn't exist at that point. It was just an idea on a piece of paper.
But the curry ketchup is something that we would make at home. So we knew how to, you know, we were like, we know how to make that. And so she's looking at all them, and she stops at the curry ketchup, and she's like, this one looks interesting. She's like, I'd like to try it. So we're like, okay. So we're in California. Like, we run back to our Airbnb.
Did you tell her that it didn't exist? Did you tell her that
no,
this
we were like, we know how to make, we were like,
you're just like, really. Let me go home and grab some.
Yeah. No, like, she knew that it wasn't in market, you know? And I don't know if she thought that we were going to send it to her as fast as we did, but she was like, I'd like to try it. So we go back to we're in an Airbnb. We make the recipe. We overnight it to her at her office, and like a day or two later, and I remember we stayed in California at my and we were at my uncle's house when we get this call, and she's like, oh my God. She's like, I got the sample. I'm obsessed with it. She's like, everybody in the office loves it. She's like, we definitely want to take this national. And we were like, oh my God, that's awesome. And then she was like, can you also develop a curry mustard for us? And I was like, sure. And so, like, the next, you know, like, a few months, I worked on developing the curry mustard. And those launched, like, this, I guess, like, June.
Wow. What's the response been like?
It's been great. I mean, we actually checked in with her again at the last show we were at, and we were like, well, you know, what do you think? And she's like, they're doing pretty well. She's like, I'm happy with how they're doing. And she's like, I have to say, she was like, there was a couple of other products we launched at the same time as yours. And she's like, and your, you know, projections were not supposed to be as high as they were. So, you know. So it was like a good thing. We're like, whoa, it worked.
I think you said a little bit earlier in the episode that there was like a bunch of different types of mustard in the curry mustard. Can you talk about how they're different? What kind of mustard seeds we usually eat in our mustard? And
yeah. So we use like a brown mustard and a yellow mustard whole seed, and then we use like a mustard flour that adds a little bit of pungency to it. And oh my God, I had like 50 samples of mustard going when I was testing this recipe, because the flavor of mustard changes over time, right? So it's like it depending on how you make it, it can become kind of like, it just like doesn't taste like anything. And or if you have too much of another flavor, that flavor becomes like the pronounced flavor of it. So it's like I had to play around a lot with the flavors to get it to where we liked it, and the consistency as well. I always have liked kind of like a little bit of a grain, but also like a little bit of a creamy kind of mustard. So that's what I was going for with this. And it was important for me to kind of impart the flavor of tamarind into it, because I felt like that would bring something fruity, but also tangy at the same time, and didn't want the tang just to be coming from the vinegar that we use too. And then also coming up with this curry spice blend that is a mixture of you know, Indian spices and the flavors that I grew up with, and kind of like melding this all together. And, you know, curry mustard and curry ketchup actually exist. It's like a German thing. And that was something that we kind of learned later on.
We just have a few minutes left, but I did want to talk more about the word curry and the concept. So could you unpack that for us a little bit? The complexity of that word and the weight that it carries.
So the word curry is definitely one that is kind of like a very contentious word. I'd say that there's like kind of like the whole British colonization of India and wrapping up all of Indian food basically into this one word, which is problematic. And there's also the side of curry, which is, it's just the colloquial use of the word curry. People know when you say, for instance, my parents say, we made a potato curry. It's like, I know that they made a curry. They made a potato. They made potatoes that are flavored with Indian spices or masala, right? And so So in that sense, it's like it can mean so many different things. But we use the word for the ketchup as a definer to signify to people that this is a ketchup that has Indian flavors in it. And, you know, I had internal strife with what to call this product. And at one point we were going to call it just spicy ketchup. And then we were like, but that doesn't say what it is, yeah, you know?
Context.
Yeah. And then we were like, let's call it masala ketchup. And then, and so we did research with a base of like about 2,000 people, you know, testing the different labels that we have, telling them what it tastes like and what we were going for. And a lot of people were like, we don't know what masala means. Like, what does masala mean? Mm-hmm. mean? And so that was kind of like curry ketchup became the, you know, it was by far the most popular, I guess the most popular label that people kind of went for. And at the end of the day, we thought, you know, we want people to know what this is, so we're going to call it something that will, you know, tell that story.
Yeah, Chithra, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show and closing out our season. And getting to taste tomato achar. Where can our listeners find you and find your products and taste some for themselves?
They can go to brooklyndeli.com. D-E-L-H-I.
Of course.
And on social media?
Also Brooklyn Deli. And then I'm at Chithra on Instagram.
And this is also, we're closing out Heritage Radio Network's donation drive. At the
donation
end of the
drive.
Month, we're trying to raise about $150,000 by the end of the year, which is ambitious, but I think with your help, dear listener, we can make it happen.
The singular listener.
Yeah, exactly. It's HRN's 10th year, and as you may or may not know, there are a lot of shows on the network, and it's an amazing platform to talk about entrepreneur stories like Chithra's and all of the other cool guests that we've had. And as a nonprofit, we really appreciate your support. So heritageradionetwork.org/donate. You can mention our show. You can mention other shows. You can, as always, contact us with any questions or comments or requests, nominations. We love it when people suggest guests to have on. We are yfood@heritageradionetwork.org or at yfoodpodcast on Facebook and Instagram. You can find me via my spice company at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram, burlapandbarrel.com.
And you can always find me at Chef Jenny Dorsey. And thanks again to our sound engineer, Matt. And our theme song is Blind by the Red Crickets.
And we will see you in January.
In three weeks.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.